You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
There are about 18 more hours left of the 2016 campaign before New Yorkers can begin voting at 6 a.m. tomorrow morning. And for many of us, that can't come soon enough. Comedians and satirists especially have noted their weariness trying to cover the two nominees and the hyperbolic and apocalyptic rhetoric from both sides, which has seemed to veer beyond satire at times. Here to take us through some of the most memorable moments of the presidential election, some which may seem as made up as many of the claims made during this very long campaign, is Andy Borowitz, a humorist, best-selling author, and the man behind the New Yorker's Borowitz Report. Welcome back to our show.
Good to be here, Leonard. It is almost over, thank God.
And yeah, so you're happy about that.
Yes.
Are there certain public figures you hope will return to their day jobs?
Oh, dear. Almost all of them. I mean, the problem is it is sort of a zombie movie that we're in because they never totally go away. I mean, you know, we think we're sick of Donald Trump, but keep in mind Ted Cruz is still out there roaming among us for some reason. And it's I do think that H.L. Mencken, who was kind of a horrible human being in a lot of ways, but a very funny writer, actually addressed this issue of failed presidential candidates really well in an essay called Imperial Purple, where he suggested that if you lose a presidential election, you just be hanged, because he thought there was a disposal problem. And there is, kind of, because as we've seen in these debates, losers keep coming back, like Rick Santorum. They just don't go away. So I think that we do need to address this disposal problem in some way.
A couple of weeks ago, you wrote an article, Nation Unsure It Can Tolerate 13 More Days of Rudy Giuliani.
That was just straight fact reporting. That's just a fact of our experience of Rudy Giuliani. People went through different phases with Rudy during this campaign. First, there was the phase of trying to remember exactly who he was. That lasted for a bit, and then we moved quickly to frustration, exhaustion. And he's still, I mean, he's a bad penny. He's one of these guys that, again, H.L. Mencken had a good fix for that. He just keeps coming back.
Well, Newt Gingrich popped up again. David Brock on the other side.
Mm-hmm. They don't go away. Part of it is maybe we need some kind of job retraining for these people. They're not employable in anything productive in our society. So Newt Gingrich kind of lives at Meet the Press. I think he has a cot there. And I would love to see Newt Gingrich maybe at the salad bar at Applebee's or something like that, doing something productive, maybe refilling the Bako bits or something like that. But he has no training. He's not good at anything. And so instead, we have to see him as a pundit every 4 years.
In your latest column, you imagine FBI Director James Comey's level of disappointment that Clinton is once again cleared of any wrongdoing, calling the discovery that Clinton could not be prosecuted for wrongdoing was probably the darkest hour of my career at the FBI, you write, and that he would then move from what he called a shattering disappointment for me personally.
Yeah, I mean, that story, again, is more or less just straight fact reporting on my part. I'm really just reporting on the thought bubble above James Comey's head as he announces that Hillary is actually not a criminal.
Of course, he would deny that, you know.
He would deny that. It's just been very weird. The late sort of third act entry of the FBI into this drama really kind of even took me by surprise. I'm always trying to come up with the most outlandish scenarios for my stories, but the notion that the FBI would suddenly start meddling in the political process, it made me nostalgic for the times when the FBI and the Russians weren't on the same side. I'm showing my age, but I sort of like the idea of the FBI and the Russians being opposed to each other, but they've been on the same page this time around. It's been
and
weird.
You have Donald Trump blasting the FBI director. I thought Comey was rigged, and then I thought he was unrigged, and now I think he's rigged again.
Yeah.
Then you have him end by saying, lock him up.
You know, again, I reported this yesterday, and then I was watching this, and this will point to a larger problem that you kind of touched on in your prelude, which was that I saw on the news this morning on CNN that basically Donald Trump said exactly what I wrote for him last night. It always, I'm glad in this campaign when at least I get out in front of Donald Trump by 4 or 5 minutes. It's usually very difficult to do because usually he says the insane thing before I can think of it. But in fact, he's now going back to saying everything's rigged. It's a really interesting flexibility of mind that he has where he can sort of lurch back and forth to polar opposites with no seeming difficulty or strain.
A number of people have pointed out that this election seems beyond satire sometimes.
Yes, I'm one of the 20 million people who've pointed that out. Donald Trump comes fully pre-satirized. There's nothing you can do. I mean, there was a great New Yorker cartoon in the last year where it showed a cartoonist. And it was just, I'm sure, autobiographical for whoever did it. And I'm sorry I'm not crediting the guy who did it because I don't remember whose it was. But it showed a cartoonist working at his desk, and his wife runs in the room and says, "Stop what you're doing. Trump just said the joke that you're doing." You know, and it's like it has been that problem. I mean, and some of it is a question of after a certain point, you're just sort of reporting and maybe framing it slightly, but you can't. He's not actually a good target for satire. People come up to me on the street and say, "You must be having just the time of your life with all of this material." And I'm not on the same page. I am actually sitting before you today, Leonard, a broken man. I've been ground into dust by this campaign.
It was better in the old days for Will Rogers or even Bob Hope.
Well, let's try to leave Bob Hope out of this conversation. But no, Will Rogers.
He did get a lot of laughs on politics.
Yeah, he did. Will Rogers actually had the one quote that I always requote because it kind of summed it up, which was, he was probably, the greatest political satirist in American history. And he said, "There's no trick to being a humorist when you have the whole government working for you." And he would have loved the whole Comey thing because who would have guessed that the FBI, what's next? Like the DMV is going to try to tip this election. It's just amazing the cast of characters here, the expanding cast of characters, the unexpected return of Anthony Weiner. Speaking of zombies, we thought that he was out of the picture, and then he pops back in. I guess I shouldn't have used the word pop.
But yeah, should not.
He reappears.
It's a growing problem.
No. Let's not even – I don't even want to start. I opened this idiotic pun door, and it's going to just trap us both. And I didn't mean to. But Weiner comes back. None of them go away. Again, it's this – to get back to Mencken, it's a disposal problem we have. We have to find some way of disposing of these people so they don't return.
I speak with Andy Borowitz, New York Times bestselling author and humorist who's written for The New Yorker since 1998. And now his Borowitz Report is made available through The New Yorker. We are talking about the election. We have one more day to do this. One of the most memorable moments from the campaign took place over a year ago on August 6, 2015, during the first GOP primary debate, and when Megyn Kelly asked Trump a question about his temperament.
Mr. Trump, one of the things people love about you is you speak your mind and you don't use a politician's filter. However, that is not without its downsides, in particular when it comes to women. You've called women you don't like fat pigs, dogs, slobs, and disgusting animals. Your Twitter account is
only Rosie O'Donnell.
Do you think that another candidate might have been seriously damaged by that and the exchange that followed?
Well, let me say,
like a bleeding through or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, let me say a couple things about that moment because I think that was a very pivotal moment. First of all, I think that one really regrettable thing about this campaign and Donald Trump's role in it is that he and the campaign have put millions of Americans in the really uncomfortable position of siding with Megyn Kelly. I mean, before this election, so easy to paint her as one of these horrible Fox News people, and now we actually love Megyn Kelly. It's all a question of relativity, of course. You put her opposite Donald Trump, and that's what you have.
She's earning many millions of dollars more now as a result of that and Roger Ailes.
She is. Well, her sort of supporting role with Gretchen Carlson in the deposing of Roger Ailes does make her kind of a quiet hero as in what passes for heroism in today's media. But getting back to that moment, You know, there's a friend of mine, who's a wonderful novelist named Jennifer Vanderbess, once made this observation about dating. And she said that on your first date, the person you're dating really reveals himself. She said, you know, they really tell you, they may not be trying to, but they really show you who they are. And then you might actually have a relationship with this person for 2 years. And then when it ends badly, you go back to the first date and you say, oh my God, he totally gave me every red flag and I ignored it. Mm-hmm. Well, that debate, which was the first Republican debate, and that question, which was the first question posed to Donald Trump, was really America's first date with Donald Trump as a presidential candidate. And then, you know, a year later, when we heard the now wonderfully archived Access Hollywood tape of him speaking about molesting and assaulting women, there was this weird shock about that where people were stunned. And yet I said, go back to that first date. He revealed himself. We knew everything about this guy.
Well, he continued. He used his Twitter account to continue his feud with Megyn Kelly and even boycotted the next GOP primary debate that was hosted by Fox because Megyn Kelly was going to be one of the moderators. That, again, might have really damaged most candidates. When I think back to Rick Perry not being able to remember the third agency he would get rid of, when they asked Donald Trump what agencies he would get rid of, he said the Department of Environmental, the DEP. He also said that he was down at the World Trade Center on 6/11. Where is it? 7/11.
He was at the 7/11. 7/11 when it happened. And he also did not know the date of the election.
Yes,
he said it was like November 28th. Yeah.
Other candidates would be hurt by that, but this just seems to add to his appeal.
Well, you've asked one of the key questions, which is how far can this bar be lowered? The bar has been lowered precipitously over the last really several elections. I think that the nomination of Sarah Palin, we saw sort of a quantum drop for the bar. And here, this was this related to Sarah as well, but here, his ignorance and his offensiveness and his horribleness is not at all, it's not seen through the filter of gaffes or mistakes. They're actually badges of honor. They're qualifications that and I think the mainstream media, and I know that's an overused term, but I think they really sort of miscalculated. They really thought that, oh, well, he makes fun of prisoners of war. He makes fun of John McCain. He says terrible things about women. This is all going to catch up with them. They did not recognize that he was leading with these as strengths. These were all strengths for him, and his core supporters loved his quote-unquote political incorrectness.
The Saturday Night Live opener this week was about how the only thing that the mainstream media seemed to be interested in are Hillary Clinton's campaign, the emails, not any of the things that Donald Trump does that are pretty shocking during that bit.
Well, you know, the other thing that's been very hard as a comedian to make fun of in this race has been the media, because the media has become pre-satirized. The media has become such a joke. And I don't want to paint it all with one brush, because some people, like PolitiFact, for example, has done a great job at a really thankless task this time around, which is trying to fact check these people. So they've done great. But if you watch, say, cable news and you see this ridiculous false equivalency that they try to enforce, you look at this and you just say, you know, forced balance is the death of reason. When you take two people, let's say we just went out in the hallway at WNYC and we chose any two people, you would immediately be able to discern differences between those two people. One might be better educated than the other, one might be smarter than the other, one might have more impulse control problems than the other. And we would make those discernments. But when you enter the green room at CNN, you automatically become leveled. Everybody, it's like that old TV show, The Equalizer. They will try to make everybody the same. And it comes not entirely from a good place. A lot of it comes from a very craven place, which is they do not want to alienate any member of their incredibly shrinking viewership. And that's to me sort of the undercovered story of this election, which is the collapse of the business model for these media companies has required them to pander to Trump.
I often get emails from listeners who complain that I have leaned too far in one direction or another in discussing issues of this sort, there's this real feeling that to be objective means you have to be totally balanced. On the one hand, this; on the other hand, that. Even as you say, when there's a false equivalency,
I feel like, and I'm not a tremendously spiritual person, but I feel like if Jesus ever came back, he'd go on CNN, but CNN would insist on a split screen with Satan, and they'd let them argue for about 5 minutes about good versus evil, and then they would say, "Gentlemen, we have to leave it there." That is sort of what we've devolved to. I think that, I was watching this morning and a Trump surrogate. I don't know, by the way, why I watch this, except that I like to torture myself. But I was watching cable news and a Trump surrogate was saying that there had been media bias against Donald Trump. And I actually think there has not been enough media bias. I think media bias is another way of saying point of view. And I think there should be media bias, for example, against fascism. And when you see fascism, you should call it out and say, hey, this dude's a fascist. And I would like to have seen more of that. But again, in the sort of spirit of gentlemen, we have to leave it there. You're not going to see it on cable news, at least not in 2016.
And we're going to have to leave it there for a moment. We're going to take a little break. Andy Burowitz has published two recent bestsellers, The 50 Funniest American Writers, the first title in the history of the Library of America to make the Times bestseller list. Also a memoir, An Unexpected Twist, which was a number one bestseller. Amazon named the best Kindle single of 2012. We're discussing the current election cycle with just hours to go. Stay with us for more. We're back with Andy Burowitz. We're talking about the election. What else? In the second debate, Donald Trump tells Hillary what she could expect if he's elected president.
It's just awfully good that someone with the temperament of Donald Trump is not in charge of the law in our country.
Because you'd be in jail.
Secretary Clinton.
Under what possible circumstances would Hillary Clinton be thrown in jail if Donald Trump were elected?
Well, I mean, she has single-handedly rigged our country. I mean, there must be an anti-rigging law somewhere that can be invoked. I also don't really know how due process or any kind of judicial process would work if Donald Trump were president, because his fans and his supporters and now he himself seem to want to go directly to locking people up, which, again, you know, it's a derivative point of view. I mean, a lot of people have said that before him. Kim Jong-un, for example. But he it's an interesting perspective. I mean,
does he want Comey locked up, do you think?
I think he does want Comey locked up. I've reported that. I mean, yeah, it's an interesting window into what a lot of people think. When you go to those Trump rallies, which I have not actually attended, but George Saunders at The New Yorker went to a bunch of them, and I've certainly watched my share of them on TV, you realize there are a lot of people in the country who don't necessarily like the idea of people putting on trial. They want to go directly to incarceration. And they also don't like other ideas, like the whole idea. Women apparently can vote in our country, and there are a lot of that was upsetting to learn that. And there are a lot of people wearing T-shirts saying get rid of, you know, women's right to vote. So one thing that you could say maybe is a positive, I'm trying to look for any good news in this election that I can find, Leonard. And one is that as unpleasant as it's been, we've gotten to see some of the worst in America. I mean, Hillary was roundly criticized for using the term deplorable, but actually getting rid of things like the women's right to vote is kind of deplorable, I think. And I think it's been good that we've kind of been able to look under the rock and see what's there, because it gives us a sense of what the country as a whole has to contend with and how far we have to go.
Well, not just Donald Trump. Many people in the party are talking about impeaching Hillary Clinton if she's elected president.
Now, that I think is very impressive. I'm a big fan of sci-fi, and I think that this means that the people saying that have a time machine, because they've actually been able to go past January 20th when Hillary is sworn in and know already that she's done something that's impeachable. You know, I've sort of looked this up. And things that you've done, like maybe as a kid or as a teenager or even as Secretary of State, don't really apply as impeachable offenses. You really have to be president first. So again, I know I'm sort of, I feel sometimes like I'm in Schoolhouse Rock, like I'm explaining very sort of remedial things to people. But all the people who want to impeach Hillary, just hang in there. Wait till January 20th and then start impeaching her. You can't do it yet.
Do you imagine a scenario in which the other branches of government would support some of the campaign promises, like deporting millions of undocumented workers, banning all Muslims, building the wall along our border with Mexico, not honoring our NATO commitments, bringing all overseas jobs back to the United States, renegotiating all of our trade deals, among others?
The answer is no. I don't see any of that happening. I think actually... I think he'd have a lot of trouble. You know, he wants to also at least dabble with using nuclear weapons. He feels that he's a businessman and he thinks, look, you've built all this great stuff. Why aren't you using it? Like, I built a casino. Of course, you want to have people like gambling at the casino. So he feels the same way about our incredibly great, huge nuclear arsenal. Totally, it's world class, although he thinks it should also be newer. Like, he thinks our arsenal is too old. But once he upgrades it and we have like gold-plated nuclear weapons, he wants to use them a ton. And it was interesting.
Has he suggested where? Eisenhower had similar ideas, but he was going to build all rivers and canals and such by using bombs. And then he was talked out of that.
Yeah. Well, Eisenhower made the mistake of saying that out loud a couple of times. And actually, Jeff Frank wrote a really good book about Ike and Dick and their relationship. And he talked about Eisenhower was a little bit too bullish on nuclear weapons, and he had to sort of be taken aside and say, no, don't use them. There are only a couple of, I would say, sort of silver linings about, you know, trying to imagine Trump as commander-in-chief. One is that maybe he, with his attentional problems, will not actually remember the nuclear codes. I'm sort of holding out hope for that they'll say it's 4, 6, 7, 8, 9, and he'll be like, what did Rosie O'Donnell say? He'll just be sidetracked. He'll be on Twitter or something.
Taken his Twitter account away.
I know. That's, you know, Melissa and I were talking, your producer, executive producer, a little bit about this when I was waiting. Donald Trump, we've now entered the infant care phase of the campaign where they're like cooing him to sleep at night. Like, he can't sleep at night. So, like, you know, Jared Kushner, his son-in-law, has to like whisper sweet nothings into his ear about like, you're great. Yeah. It's like unbelievable. I mean, they're like having to sort of control all of his impulse. It's like Donald Trump now is like a colicky baby who has to be kind of rocked to sleep. Leaving that aside, that is all fact. That's in the New York Times. The only other hope for him as commander-in-chief, and this is a little bit of history, which is that when Nixon was president, Nixon wasn't widely reported, but Nixon really liked to drink quite heavily. He liked to pour these very stiff sort of tall boys of like dark drinks like whiskey, you know, bourbon, scotch, stuff like that. And after about 8 or 9 at night, as heavy drinkers will do, his judgment started becoming slightly impaired, and he would call up generals and say, I want you to like drop a nuke on Hanoi or something like that. And just routinely, the generals learned just to tune him out after a certain time at night. So at Donald Trump, the time at which they would have to tune him out would probably be like at 7 a.m. They'd have to probably do it all day long. But it is, I mean, I do think, I mean, some generals have come out and said, look, you know, he wants to reinstitute torture. Dude, we're just not doing that. So, I mean, there are some safeguards. It's still does not make me feel comfortable enough that I don't think everybody in their power should get out there and try to keep him away from the nuclear codes. I think we should still try to do that tomorrow.
I'm talking with humorist, best-selling author, and the man behind the New Yorker's Borowitz Report, Andy Borowitz. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. What do you see as the driving force behind the populist sentiments that really have grown over this election campaign?
Well, I think there is a lot of desperation. I think there are some people who feel, even though the economic measures by almost every yardstick have improved dramatically under Obama, and that's not only the most ardent conspiracy theorist like Donald Trump would say, well, they've rigged all the numbers and it's really bad.
He once said that there's a 40% unemployment rate in the United States.
That's right. There isn't even a 40% unemployment rate among his kids. They're all like, he's made sure that they're all working. But no, there is if I may just be sincere for one moment, a lot of people are hurting out there, and a lot of people are suffering, and it's why, on you know, a gentleman who I genuinely admire, Bernie Sanders, really did resonate with a lot of voters who feel left behind and left out by prosperity and by the recovery, which has been not terrible, but not as robust as a lot of people would like. The problem with populism, though, when you get into Trump land, is that it starts tipping over into things like nativism, xenophobia, sexism, racism, and also an embrace of ignorance, which is that we want somehow to have candidates who tell it like it is, which means they just tell things that aren't true, and they tell they're not well-informed. I actually have a different movement that I'm trying to promote, and it's going to be very unpopular because it's kind of the opposite of populism. My movement is actually called elitism, and my movement is based – I know it sounds bad. I've got to work on the marketing end of it. The branding is terrible. But where my movement comes in is I am of the belief that we should elect – politicians who are smarter than we are. I think the president of the United States should be one of the smartest people in the country.
I don't think that's ever happened, Andy.
Well, I think we've had some smart people. I think Barack Obama was the president of the Harvard Law Review. That is a smart guy. But the problem with all of our candidates now, and this started, it started a few decades ago, but I think it reached its kind of apogee with George W. Bush. You can tell I'm an elitist because I use words like apogee. But George W. Bush did really well in all the polls, like when it was him versus Al Gore, or then in 2004, him versus John Kerry. He did very well in any poll where they asked, who would you rather have a beer with? And if ever there was the worst metric for measuring who the president of the United States should be, I mean, the people I have beers with are uniformly dumbasses. I do not want them anywhere near the nuclear codes. And so we've got to like make a decision in this country. And again, I'm the worst messenger for this, but we have to make a decision that we actually want people running things who are smart. And I think that the problem with populism is that it starts with a good place, which is supporting the people, supporting bringing in people who are feeling left behind. But it ultimately often ends up with just ignorance and an embrace of ignorance. I think that's a really bad road to go down.
It was a silly question because George Bush by that time had become a teetotaler.
That's true.
But we true. Have. Do you think the alt-right has always been there and the KKK has just come out now because they feel it's safer to come out now?
Yeah, I do think it's always been. I mean, we've always had racism, sexism, nativism in our country. We had it in the 30s. We had it when it was raging in Europe. And there were a lot of people who sort of said, yeah, Hitler, he's got some good ideas. I think one of the differences, and this is a key difference, and I apologize again for being serious, but the what's changed is that the Republican Party this time around is actually like embracing it. Because if you the election I use as sort of a analogy for this election was in the 90s in Louisiana when the Republican Party actually nominated David Duke, the Grand Dragon of the KKK. At that time, the establishment National Republican Party was so appalled by this that they disavowed him and actually endorsed the Democratic alternative, which was Edwin Edwards, who actually was a criminal and eventually did get locked up. But leaving that aside, we've come so far in this country in a negative way. We've devolved so far that now you have a guy, Donald Trump, who is espousing fascist, racist, xenophobic, and anti-Semitic comments, which is weird since he has Jewish grandchildren. But he's saying all this stuff, and people like Paul Ryan are kind of like, you know, keeping him at arm's length but still supporting him. And that's, to me, if we want to use a Donald Trump word, disgrace. That's a disgrace.
With all the focus on the presidential campaigns, have we spent too little time looking at their running mates, Mike Pence and Tim Kaine?
Well, I don't think we want to look that much more at Mike Pence. Mike Pence, to me, is one of the scariest people in the world. You know, this is another case.
Many people are talking about him running for the president if Trump loses in 4 years from now.
Right. So instead of having a nominee who hates women, we'll have a nominee who hates women and gays. That'll be like a real good upgrade for the Republicans. Mike Pence, if you talk to anybody in Indiana, they're absolutely appalled by the fact that Mike Pence is now considered like the normal guy in that ticket. Again, it's sort of like the Megyn Kelly situation. Just relatively speaking, he seems normal because he doesn't have crazy impulse control problems every time he gets in front of a microphone. But let's not make a mistake, America. Mike Pence is not normal.
There still appear to be undecided voters. What are they waiting for? More information about the candidates?
You know, yeah, maybe we should maybe have like a longer campaign so that we get to really hash this out. You know, it's so easy to take a shot at undecided voters. But the fact is, like, just when you get up to the – if you're undecided and genuinely undecided, just when you get up to the point where you've made up your mind, there's new opposition research and a new horrible negative ad that comes out that basically makes you say, no, that person is going to bring about the apocalypse. So for me, I think here's my way of breaking down this choice. If the United States were a car – there is actually only one candidate with a driver's license. That is Hillary Clinton. Donald Trump does not even have a learner's permit, and he hasn't even shown interest in looking at the booklet at the DMV. Gary Johnson does not know how to work the GPS, and Jill Stein does not believe in cars. So I really think we're down to just one choice. We may not all be crazy about it, but there's only one person who actually can give us a ride home at this point.
What about the way the rest of the world is viewing all of this? India and Russia seem to be strongly in support of Trump, but the rest of the world is not. And Donald Trump has been hung in effigy in England and Ireland and elsewhere.
Yeah, well, we're off to a great start with the rest of the world if Donald Trump is our president. I mean, we have become, and this is regardless of the outcome of this election, and there's no way to fix this in the short term, we have become the laughingstock of the world. We have provided entertainment for the entire world. So as much as I've said that this election has not been good for comedy and it's been hard to make fun of, the rest of the world has had no problem enjoying the election with us as the butt of their jokes.
Andy Borowitz is a best-selling author and humorist. You can read his Borowitz Report by going to
NewYorker.com. Yeah.
And as always, it's been a pleasure having you on our show.
Thanks, Leonard.